It is Friday, January the 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, President Trump on immigration and the inter-Korean talks.
Who knows where it leads? Hopefully it'll lead to success for the world, not just for our country, but for the world. And we'll be seeing over the next number of weeks and months what happens.
Southern European nations meeting about migration. Russia and the U.S. news media, not a friendly story for either side, plus copyright issues from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Before we get to the Korea story, we have this story to tell you about. President Trump has stunned lawmakers. That happened on Thursday when he reportedly referred to Haiti and African nations with an expletive, meaning dirty and impoverished. We can't say the word here, but the comment came during a White House meeting on immigration. Mr. Trump said the United States should let in more people from places such as Norway, whose prime minister met with him in the White House on Wednesday. The White House neither confirmed nor denied if the president used the crude language when talking about Haiti and Africa. You can get more information on that story at our website, voanews.com. Now, Korea. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will travel to Vancouver, Canada next week for a high-level ministerial meeting on addressing North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile program. Tillerson heads to Vancouver for that meeting, which State Department Director of Policy Planning Brian Hook said will not include Russia, China, or Japan. However, Hook said China and the United States have the same goals in denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
China has the same policy goal in terms of ensuring that North Korea does not become a nuclear weapon state and acquire the means to deliver a nuclear warhead. So there is broad agreement in the international community about the end state. This Vancouver ministerial is something which supports all of our efforts collectively. And we have been in touch with China and Russia on this ministerial, and we will be giving them a readout when it's over and a discussion. And it will be very helpful. I think that they will welcome a lot of the actions that come out of the discussion because it all rolls up into the same policy end state.
Tillerson is scheduled to meet with Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland. The Vancouver meetings follow President Trump sounding upbeat at a news conference this week after speaking with his South Korean counterpart Moon Jae-in. They spoke by phone following the first high-level inter-Korean talks in 2 years.
A lot of good talks are going on right now, a lot of good energy. I see a lot of good energy. I like it very much, what I'm seeing. I just spoke this morning with the, as you know, with the president, President Moon of South Korea. He had some really great meetings. His representatives had a great, great meeting. And I had some very good feedback from that. So hopefully a lot of good things are going to work out.
The talks at the Panmunjom Truce Village resulted in North Korea's decision to take part in next month's Winter Olympic Games, a resumption of military discussions, and reviving of an inter-Korean hotline to defuse tensions.
Who knows where it leads? Hopefully it'll lead to success for the world, not just for our country, but for the world. And we'll be seeing over the next number of weeks and months what happens.
South Korea suggested the U.S. and North Korea might be able to meet, although the White House insisted it would have to be at an appropriate time and under the right circumstance. The two leaders also pledged to maintain the maximum pressure campaign over Pyongyang's nuclear and missile programs. Ken Goss is director of the International Affairs Group at the Center for Naval Analyses. He tells my colleague Victor Beatty the only way the North will engage in talks with the U.S. is if Washington changes its long-standing policy on denuclearization.
I think the only way that North Korea will come to the table, the negotiating table, is if there are no preconditions. That means the United States cannot put denuclearization as a precondition for talks. If they do, the North Koreans will not come to the table. I think the U.S. needs to focus on denuclearization as being the ultimate objective, but not as a precondition for negotiations.
President says he sees a lot of good energy in the talks between the Koreas. I like it very much, he said. He thinks we will have peace through strength, referring to his policy of ensuring peace through a strong military.
And again, that would be also suggestive of the idea that if the U.S. can make North Korea believe that all options are on the table, including the military option, that it might make North Korea more willing to come to the table. I would argue, on the other hand, that North Korea is adamant about not giving up its nuclear program, and I think that it's very well worth us, the United States, to really seriously look at the assumptions that we have behind any potential courses of action against North Korea, especially the military course.
President Moon, in a news conference on Wednesday, gave President Trump some credit for the atmosphere that made it conducive for talks at Panmunjom.
I think that President Moon is in a very difficult situation. President Moon has to keep both North Korea and the United States invested in some sort of diplomatic solution. On the North Korea side, he has to figure out, what can he do to keep North Korea invested in continued inter-Korean dialogue past the time of the Olympics? And that probably means having to think about what sort of incentives you can put on the table, such as economic and possible security incentives, to keep North Korea interested in that dialogue. On the other hand, he has to be very careful that he keeps the United States invested. And that means that making sure that the United States does not get in its mind that this is some sort of a trap by North Korea, that they're driving a wedge between the United States and South Korea, that South Korea has to make it very clear that they are very close in terms of their alliance with the U.S. And so giving deference to the American president for making this happen is something I think in terms of his information campaign toward the United States to ensure that the U.S. stays invested.
Ken Gause also said that since North Korea views the U.S. as its top existential threat, it is compelled to keep its nuclear deterrent. But he also said there is another reason why the U.S. needs to drop its policy of denuclearized Korean Peninsula. He said that Kim Jong-un sees the nuclear program as intimately tied to his own legitimacy. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Heads of seven southern European nations have pledged to continue their efforts to tackle their biggest issue at hand, and that is the flow of migrants from war-torn and impoverished countries. The leaders of Cyprus, France, Greece, Italy, Malta, Portugal, and Spain met in Rome, where they released a statement saying they were firmly committed to a common European policy on migration. Reporter Catherine Field spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the main issues of concerns for those seven European countries.
This is the so-called Southern Seven, the fourth meeting that they've had, and the fact that it's happened so early in the year is a real indication of how seriously countries, particularly Spain, Italy, Greece, and France, are concerned that they are carrying the burden, what they describe as the burden of all these migrant and refugee arrivals. They're very concerned that northern European states are saying that they're not prepared to take any of the migrants who are coming in. And this is really an indication that these countries want the European Union, on the one hand, to change the so-called Dublin law that wherever the migrants arrive, whichever country they arrive in, they have to be dealt with in that country. On the other hand, what has come up really in these discussions has been that, yes, there have been changes, in particular in Greece and in Italy, there are fewer migrants arriving. There are a lot more migrants now arriving in Spain, and in particular, a lot of new arrivals coming in from Algeria and Morocco. And these so-called southern states want the European Union to recognize that the measures they've put in place so far just haven't worked. And if they close off one avenue for arrival into Europe, another one is just opening up.
What are some of the big things that they focused on in this meeting in terms of migrants?
The big focus is really on what they've called the humanitarian corridors. Now, what that means is that you're setting up, if you like, an air bridge, which would allow countries, and it's already started, countries such as Italy and France, to actually fly in migrants from either Libya or elsewhere in the Sahel, people who really have got a justified need for protection. And that what Italy and France in particular are saying is you have got to go down to these countries, you've got to talk to these people, register there, your asylum request there, and deal with it there, because unless they get the backing from the European Union to deal with those issues there, then migrants going to keep coming across in boats across the Mediterranean.
Why is France still at the forefront of the migrant issue?
Well, the French President Emmanuel Macron has insisted that France cannot take in everyone. In particular, he's referring to the fact that in 2017, France received more than 100,000 requests for asylum. Now, that's a record. It's up 17% from the year before. As far as Emmanuel Macron is concerned, what he also wants is he wants that G5 African military force in the Sahel to not just work in fighting against terrorism, but also to stop people smugglers. And so Emmanuel Macron feels that it's really as much up to the G5 Sahel countries to work on this as well as the European neighbors.
That is reporter Catherine Field in Paris speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. Also in the news, Russia's government threatening additional penalties against U.S. media operating in Russia. The threat is the latest in a back-and-forth dispute between Washington and Moscow over the treatment of media outlets operating in each other's countries. Charles Main reporting from Moscow.
Ever since U.S. intelligence agencies issued a report last January claiming a Russian media role in alleged Kremlin meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, the media have been garnering unwelcome headlines. First, the U.S. demanded the Russian state-affiliated RT News Service register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, or FARA, an 80-year-old law first introduced to counter Nazi propaganda during World War II. In response, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a law designating foreign media as foreign agents. Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and several affiliated projects with U.S. government backing were soon added to the list. Then, this week, Russia's state-affiliated media outlet Sputnik announced that the United States was forcing its parent company, RIA Global, to register under FARA by early February. In a statement issued online, Russia's embassy in Washington called the move unacceptable and alleged that Russian journalists face problems with visas, as well as harassment from U.S. security services. While the U.S. has denied those allegations, Russia also warned that unavoidable mirror measures would be forthcoming without elaborating. Yet the media issue wasn't the only irritant surrounding Russia's debated role in the U.S. elections. On Thursday, the Kremlin denounced a U.S. congressional report issued by Senate Democrats that accused Russia of mounting a protracted and asymmetrical assault on democracy in the U.S. and elsewhere. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called the report part of an ongoing baseless and groundless campaign against Russia. RT editor-in-chief Margarita Simonyan also weighed in, deriding the report as boring. "Wake me up in 5 years when they find nothing and don't want to admit there was no Russian interference," she said. Yet the issue is unlikely to disappear soon. While the U.S. Congress has multiple ongoing investigations into Russian election meddling, Russian lawmakers have been conducting their own. Of key interest to the Duma is how U.S. media might seek to influence Russia's presidential elections, slated for March 2018. Charles Mayne for VOA News, Moscow.
Sporadic protests continue across parts of Tunisia as the government security forces trying to stop the scattered violence that hit a number of regions. Edward Uranian is following the story.
Tunisian government security forces used tear gas to quell violence across the country amid scattered protests that erupted last week following price increases imposed by the government. The Interior Ministry reported that several hundred people were arrested during the past 24 hours. Prime Minister Youssef Chahed, visiting a region hit by violence, told journalists irresponsible politicians were trying to stir up trouble and provoke a wave of vandalism. He says encouraging social unrest, violence, and pillage by bringing young people out into the streets who then get arrested is not in anyone's interest. He claims it only benefits the corrupt and those who want to weaken the state. He says the government is standing firm, along with the army and security forces, in protecting the country. Some political leaders urge the government to impose martial law to stop the violence. Spokesman Ziad Akhtar of the Popular Front political umbrella group that has been spearheading some of the protests called the prime minister's remarks irresponsible and called for an independent inquiry into who is provoking the violence. One protester told Arab media his main goal is to force the government to reverse its decision to introduce a value-added tax and raise prices on some basic staples. He says protesters want to force the government to scrap this year's budget and then freeze or lower prices since the people continue to get poorer. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq tells VOA economic issues that prompted the 2011 Arab Spring Revolution, which overthrew then-President Zain al-Abidine Ben Ali, still plagued the country.
The biggest trouble for Tunisia is that the economy is suffering. The economy had not been able to stand up and revive itself after the 2011 revolution, and the same slogans regarding unemployment and poverty, corruption still remain.
But Sadiq does not believe the recent protests will incite a new revolution. The violence has been amplified, he argues, by some politicians calling for protests at night rather than during the day, which is the usual custom in Tunisia. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
Doctors are saying this year's flu season in the U.S. is moderately severe. It could even get worse, sending lots of people to the hospital, many dying from the flu or its complications. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that many people are thinking that it's just a bad cold, but it turns out to be deadly.
The flu is now widespread across the U.S., hospitalizations doubling in a week. Hardest hit is California, where there are so many cases, some hospitals are triaging flu patients in tents or in the hallways of emergency rooms. Dr. Adrian Cotton at Loma Linda University Health says many people don't understand how serious the flu can be.
Most people think of the flu as a cold, and I'm going to get over it. It's hopefully people get over it, but not everybody does.
In California, 7-year-old Cisco Galvez died from the virus. His mother, Juanita Vidana, is devastated.
It happened so fast, in days, you know, in a matter of days, and I never expected it. He was very healthy.
Nationwide, more than 41,000 cases have been reported. In California, close to 30 people have died. Dr. Sayun Tehalo-Lipavan is a health officer with San Diego County, California. The predominant strain of flu that's going around has been associated in the past with more hospitalizations and death.
Influenza is here, it's severe, and we need to do whatever we can to prevent and minimize transmission.
And that includes getting vaccinated. The U.S. Health Department recommends that almost everyone get the vaccine. Flu vaccines are developed each year using the predominant flu strains that circulated in the Southern Hemisphere's winter months. Some years, the strains used to make the vaccine turn out to be different from the strains that make it to the U.S., so the vaccine is not as effective. This year's vaccine is expected to be anywhere from 10 to 30% effective. Still, doctors are advising people to get vaccinated if they haven't done so already. Dr. Christelle Ilburu with the University of Missouri Healthcare says until the flu season is over, it's a good idea to get the shot.
The flu shot is working. In my opinion, it's working because what we have in the flu shot is actually what the virus that we're seeing circulating is.
Even when the vaccine doesn't match the virus that's circulating, it often prevents the worst complications, pneumonia and death. The CDC and health agencies from 46 other countries published a study in The Lancet with new, higher mortality estimates. The new estimates use more recent data and put the number of deaths per year between 300,000 and 650,000 worldwide, depending on how severe the flu strain happens to be. The report also says the risk of death is highest in the world's poorest regions, including sub-Saharan Africa. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And still ahead, some interesting news from the world of music. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
75 years ago, this motorcycle plant was evacuated by Joseph Stalin in preparations for World War II. Today, it's making sidecar motorcycles again. The Irbit factory is located in the Urals, and a newfound demand for the retro bike comes mostly from the United States and Europe. Edward Miller of the Irbit Motorcycle Factory. He says there are no firms that make sidecar motorcycles from scratch and offer it to new buyers. These new bikes do get updated disc brakes and a drive shaft for the sidecar, and the Urbit factory makes about 1,500 sidecar motorcycles each year. But for those who want a cheaper bike, Alexander Myznikov restores old bikes, selling them cheaper. He says nostalgia is what people feel. People try to collect the World War II Soviet-made M72. He says there is a certain demand. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Well, it turns out that copyright infringement cases are nothing new in the music industry. We've all heard them. The latest instance has taken some interesting twists in the past week. Lana Del Rey and Radiohead are at odds over their respective music, but for different reasons. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald has more on all of this as he sits down with VOA's Jim Stevenson.
Finally, I'm crossing the threshold from the ordinary world to the
People are talking about a very strange copyright dispute that's going on this week. Now, usually these things are dry as dust, and they're usually settled behind the scenes. But last weekend, Lana Del Rey went on Twitter, and she said that Radiohead was suing her for similarities behind a new song from the Lust for Life album called Get Free, and Radiohead's own classic 1992 song, Creep. Now, Lana said she'd offered 40% of the song's publishing rights, but Radiohead wanted 100%, so it was going to court. She said their lawyers were relentless, and then later in concert, she said if the case went any further, Get Free could be pulled from the album. Well, Radiohead so far has not commented. They're kind of a reclusive band anyway, mm-hmm. That's not surprising. But their publisher, Warner Chappell, responded by issuing a statement saying that Lana was wrong. They were not suing her. They haven't filed for any legal action. And Radiohead never said they wanted 100% of the publishing rights. Warner Chappell did confirm that they have been in talks with Lana's people since last August, and that means that they intended for this to be settled out of court. Ironically, Radiohead was sued for copyright themselves over Creep. The Hollies claimed they stole that song from the 1974 hit The Air That I Breathe. This was several years ago. The songwriters later received an undisclosed out-of-court settlement. So what is the strategy here? Why was Lana pushing this? Maybe she wanted to publicize her song. Maybe she wanted to just put an end to this. Maybe she thought Radiohead's lawyers would back down. Vulture did a summation of where we are with this case. And they spoke with copyright expert Jeff Peretz and musicologist Dan Bogosian, and both said, ultimately, this is probably a win for both Lana Del Rey and Radiohead. People are discussing and streaming both songs. Mm.
That's the old Hollywood adage. It doesn't matter if the news is good or bad, as long as there's news, because people are talking about you.
Exactly right. The worst publicity is no publicity.
And we have seen many artists throughout the years and decades actually do well after a situation like this. Mm-hmm. Perhaps coming out with a song that talks about their ordeal, or, you know, some other publicity that arises.
That's exactly right. So, this little story isn't finished yet, but I would imagine that both acts will emerge from it just that much wealthier.
You'll emerge wealthier by listening to the VOA Top 20 Countdown each week. Ray McDonald is your host on VOA 1. You can also find Ray, where else? On Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits. And yeah, I have a pretty good summation of this strange little story right there for you.
Great to see. Thanks so much, Ray.
Thank you, Jim. You float like a feather in a beautiful
world. I wish I was special, but I'm a creep.
Well, I guess somebody has to be a creep, huh? Even if it's in a song. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. Top world news straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope that you have a super Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Journalism remains a dangerous profession in too many places around the world. On October 16th, Daphne Caruana Galizia, a journalist reporting on corruption in Malta as part of the Panama Papers investigation, was killed by a car bomb. In September, attackers set fire to the car of Yulia Latinina, a columnist for Novaya Gazeta and host of a weekly radio show in Russia. Protecting journalists and media practitioners against violence from those who may want to censor them is a core tenet of freedom of expression, said Shannon McGuire, a media advisor with USAID's Bureau for Europe and Eurasia, promoting independent media development. Since 1992, more than 800 journalists have been murdered around the world, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ. Of those cases, 86% were killed with impunity, meaning no one has been held responsible. In Russia, which ranks in the top 10 of CPJ's list, the attack on Latinina was just the latest in a series of assaults and threats against Russian journalists and opposition figures that have not resulted in formal charges. In Ukraine, the murder of prominent investigative journalist Pavel Sheremet also remains unsolved more than a year later. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has prioritized support to independent media in Europe and Eurasia since beginning work there in 1992. Its programs focus both on the supply and demand sides of news and information, as well as advocating for greater press freedom. One such program is the Regional Investigative Journalism Network, which helps shield reporters from attack by making it more difficult for criminals to pinpoint those who have exposed their wrongdoings. In Ukraine, USAID's U-Media project has collaborated with more than 500 independent media outlets to ensure that professional journalists operate safely and protect their data in conflict areas in eastern Ukraine and Crimea while they report on the fighting and Russian occupation. Donors, policymakers, advocacy organizations, and civil society organizations must continue to exert pressure on those involved in censorship to ensure the continuation of open, public debate and the free flow of information. Journalists are not soldiers, and their cameras and pens are not weapons, said Ms. McGuire. They shouldn't need to fear the phrase, don't kill the messenger.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.